In Iraq, over a million innocent men, women, and children killed. Millions wounded. Over 5 million people displaced. Millions widowed. Millions more orphaned. In Afghanistan, tens of thousands killed. Thousands more injured. All by those recruited and trained to kill in the name of freedom and democracy. Hello, I'm Shida Diyanat-Nejad and you're watching Aperture. This week's documentary is the story of U.S. veterans and their never-ending battle back home. Physically wounded, spiritually and mentally scarred for life, picking up the pieces of their shattered lives with bitter disillusion, the one and only true companion.
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States' involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq War Diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. Were these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers? Or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans, and those that come after us, draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home? In November 2010, the U.S. Army charged five soldiers from its 5th Stryker Brigade with the killing and mutilation of several Afghan civilians for sport. The soldiers, who called themselves the Kill Team, included Private First Class Andrew Holmes, who was 19 years old at the time of the killings, and Corporal Jeremy Morlock, who was 22.
As a defense attorney, I'm representing my clients, but I'm also a part of a broader search for truth. And I, too, am interested in the truth, and I'm interested in justice. And sometimes our job as defense attorneys is to ensure that justice is served. And by that, I mean that justice is not excessive.
Daniel Conway is a former Marine staff sergeant and a military defense lawyer. Conway has defended numerous soldiers accused of misconduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, including those charged in the Haditha massacre.
PFC Holmes was required to set up security on top of a hill. Now, his team leader, Corporal Morlock, ran to the bottom of the hill and decided, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, that on January 15th, 2010, PFC Holmes did not know what Corporal Morlock was about to do.
Conway represented Private Andrew Holmes in the Stryker 5 case. As the Stryker 5 soldiers faced court-martial proceedings in 2011, Der Spiegel and Rolling Stone published gruesome pictures of the soldiers posing with the bodies of murdered Afghans. On January 15, 2010, Corporal Morlock and the so-called Kill Team murdered the first of three Afghan civilians. For months, they had been planning to kill innocent Afghans using unaccounted-for grenades.
Corporal Morlock, he took this as a target of opportunity. And Corporal Morlock was at the bottom of a hill, about 110 feet away from PFC Holmes, who was facing the opposite direction. Corporal Morlock spotted two farmers, young Afghan farmers in a field, and motioned for one of them to come over to him like this. He called the man over.
As the farmer approached, Corporal Morlock called for Private Holmes to join him at the bottom of the hill. Holmes was unaware that Morlock was about to act on his plans to kill.
When the man got to approximately 20 feet from Corporal Morlock called for PFC Holmes, who was on top of a hill. Holmes repositioned. Now at that time, PFC Holmes started running down the hill with his squad automatic machine gun and his goggles on. It was hot that morning. Started running down the hill. Corporal Morlock was already behind about a 3-foot high wall. The man was 20 feet away from Corporal Morlock. Corporal Morlock was going through what they call standard escalation of force procedures to ensure that the man didn't have any weapons. So he told the man in the local dialect to lift his shirt to demonstrate that there was no suicide vest, and he told him to turn around.
The man complied with Morlock's orders, clearly showing that he carried no weapons or explosives. Meanwhile, Holmes continued down the hill, stopping to take a drink and catch his breath.
About that time, PFC Holmes was getting down to the bottom of the hill behind the wall. He was out of breath. He was breathing hard. And he kneeled down to take a sip of water. Now, at that time, Corporal Morlock, again, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, tossed a grenade over the wall. The grenade didn't go very far. Went probably 5 or 6 feet.
Morlock had told his fellow soldiers of plans to murder civilians and frame their killings as self-defense. But until that day, Holmes had not taken Corporal Morlock seriously.
Corporal Morlock's plan, and they had talked about this, PFC Holmes never thought Corporal Morlock was serious about it because it's a psychotic plan. So PFC Holmes never took him seriously. Corporal Morlock drops the grenade over the wall and screams for PFC Holmes to shoot. PFC Holmes stands up, places his squad automatic weapon on the wall, and it lets out about a 5 to 6 round burst, which with a machine gun is an instant. Now, whether the rounds actually hit the man or not, we aren't exactly sure. PFC Holmes believed they did. Forensic evidence was inconclusive on the matter. We had probably one of the leading forensic pathologists in the world, Dr. Michael Bodden, and Dr. Bodden was unable to identify any wounds in the photos of the man that were consistent with machine gun fire.
Forensic experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, "Holmes, get down!" and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade, which of course we believed killed the man.
The Stryker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Stryker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He went, opened one tent. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon, with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, two or three times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army. Right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq, the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not capable. He was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD. And it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. You know, we've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, I mean, sickening. I mean, that's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical. Some critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, it was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image. American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, "The gentlemen, the gloves are coming off," along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as "the gloves are coming off" suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out, "There will be no abuse in my command," and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq, it went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was, do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is, how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior. The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception, but just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that, it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq? In their time coming home that would lead to this. When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there. And they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, if these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I gotta tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
I'm surprised that that's all there is. I'm surprised it's not way more. That's what I'm telling you. I know people that do the same things, and they just haven't got caught. I know people that are in gun battles in Colorado Springs and just never got arrested. Multiple times. Even between tours, I know a guy that's got gun battles in Western Terrace apartments, and there was never any arrest in it.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case.
It's a mechanical, like, reaction. It's like, the way I deal with it is, I know, like, how I deal with it and how I got so good at it is disassociated. Like, I don't think about, later I can think about it, but at the time I don't think about it. I'm taking this guy's life, I'm shooting, I'm taking a shot, and that's what I'm doing. And I don't think at all about it, killing this thing or whatever. I kill animals and shit in Iraq too. I take a shot, and then this guy dies. It doesn't bother me, but it's an enemy that I killed this guy. I do it through disassociation.
In 2010, the Army released a study on the health effects of repeated deployment. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
They say a clear conscience is the best pillow. Well, what if all you have to sleep on is memories of killing innocent women and children, of your friends dying right in front of your eyes? Those gut-wrenching, gory images no television is allowed to show. What if all you have left is a guilt-ridden, traumatic, prosthetic carcass bereft of all honor? What if all you have left is the tears of a child, scream of a mother, or the final words of a friend?
Kenneth Eastridge was open with Army recruiters about his criminal history, including a homicide charge as a juvenile. Several recruiters turned him away. But with enough persistence, Eastridge was able to convince one recruiter to enlist him despite his record of violence.
Because I was telling him, hey, I have a juvenile record, it's pretty serious. And they're like, well, what is it? And I'm like, it's reckless homicide. And they're like, homicide? I'm like, yeah, reckless homicide. I'm like, you killed somebody? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, I don't know. Like, can you call me back? And I was like, yeah, I'll call you back. And a lot of them said no, but I kept calling recruiters, and finally I found one was like, yeah, I can get you in.
A lot of them were just kicked out of the Army for being bad soldiers because they were melting down emotionally. And once they were kicked out, they were sort of cut loose and had nowhere to go. They started drinking. They were carrying weapons all the time because they were extremely paranoid. They started using a lot of drugs. You put those things together with the training of an infantry soldier, and it's not long before somebody gets killed.
Courtney Lockhart enlisted in the Army after high school as a computer operator, but was deployed to Iraq as a foot soldier. Like many soldiers, he did not want to go to Iraq.
I didn't want to go to Iraq. In Korea, there's a question they ask you, are you willing to kill someone? And I told them no, because it's against my religion. And they put a big D on my paper. And I was like, what's that mean? Like, you're the pool. I'm like, well, I'm afraid to kill somebody. But they don't care.
His traumatic experiences in Iraq, including regular roadside bomb attacks on his brigade and the deaths of close friends, haunted Courtney upon his return from deployment. Like many of the soldiers in his unit, Courtney showed many of the signs of post-traumatic stress. He began smoking marijuana to calm his nerves from nightmares and paranoia, and was discharged from the military for marijuana use and violence, but was never screened for mental illness. In 2008, Courtney Lockhart abducted an 18-year-old girl from her college dorm, robbed and attempted to rape her before killing her with a handgun. Lockhart confessed and was convicted of the murder. The jury in his case recommended life imprisonment without parole, but the judge sentenced Lockhart to death by lethal injection.
I mean, one of the things that we've learned is it's not, and the military has learned over the number of decades, it's not so easy to get people to kill. Until relatively recently, the majority of soldiers in combat never fired their weapons. Since World War II, this has become a major preoccupation of the military.
Surveys of American soldiers who served in World War II showed that only 15 to 20% actually fired their weapons, even when ordered to do so.
For most of us, it's very, very hard to shoot to kill somebody. So the military goes through great effort to teach soldiers to become killers, to desensitize them. And that's what basic training is about. There's all kinds of chants that are rather horrific about killing people because it's very hard. You have to get these people to not think about people that they're killing people.
As a result of these findings, the U.S. military intensified its training and conditioning of soldiers to fire at and kill the enemy.
Yes, forces!
Take your sector, take your sector.
Some soldiers report they find it difficult to switch off this aggressive, vigilant mentality when they return home.
If a soldier reports mental illness or problems that they're having, that can have an impact on their career. I mean, if, let's say, an officer goes in and tells his superior that I'm feeling a little off today, I think I might be losing it, I'm having a difficulty, you know, maintaining a touch with reality. Well, are you going to give that officer a job that requires him to handle weapons, to handle increased responsibilities? Are you going to promote that officer? You're not. It's going to be career damaging to self-report that. And that's where I think you see a lot of increased rates of suicide, of alcoholism, and a lot of these other acting out scenarios that we've seen from soldiers who have returned after facing those kinds of stress.
You come back and you're supposed to fit into civilian society. You know, either people want to ask, what's it like being in war? And you don't want to talk, or they don't want to hear about it. They want you to come back and, you know, hug the kids, love the wife, and you're just not quite there, and you don't feel you fit in. And so it can magnify things because you've left this whole life. You're trying to return to it, but you're not quite there for many of them. And then you've got the whole set of experiences. You've got the fact that you're on alert all the time. A car backfires, and it's like you're back on the streets of Basra. And it's just very, very hard for a lot of people to live with this.
One of the things that shocked me about learning about these crimes, about, you know, maybe a dozen soldiers all getting arrested for senseless shootings, basically, is how easy it is. It seems like a long way to go from being a law-abiding, normal person to a murderer, but really it isn't. Okay, these are guys who have extensive weapons training. They know how to not only use a weapon, but at least all the ones I'd spoken to had killed people in Iraq. One of the guys had killed over 60 people.
In the wars that we've had recently in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have, as you do in counterinsurgency type situations, you have an enemy who can't be distinguished from the civilian population. You don't know who's your enemy. So you're on a constant alert. You're fearing people on a daily basis. You're sometimes killing people without being completely certain as to who they were, because that's the nature of these types of actions.
Now, take a young man with that kind of training, that kind of experience, bring him home. Give him lots of alcohol, because that's what they did to medicate themselves. Give them some drugs. They were looking for the high of combat, and a lot of times they replaced it with crystal meth, cocaine. Give them a loaded weapon that they carry at all times. And that's what these guys did. For some reason, they didn't feel safe when they came home. And the thing that made them feel safe was carrying a loaded weapon, and they all did it. I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of people in Colorado Springs right now who are doing it. Now you combine all those things and add a little stress, a fight with somebody, someone cutting you off, a bad day. And it's very easy to kill somebody. And then you've crossed the line, and it's a very thin line between thinking it and doing it and having done it.
John Turner served as a Marine infantryman in Iraq, including tours in Fallujah and Ramadi. Since returning from war, he has become a peace activist and a vocal advocate for healing of soldiers' mental wounds.
You know, it's so easy to send somebody off to do dirty work, but come home and there's nothing, man. There's no purification, right? There's no ceremony to welcome you back to being home. And it's a shame. And it took me a long time to realize that I was home. You know, I've been back for 6 years, almost 6 years now. And I've still never had a proper welcoming ceremony.
A lot of the guys that I've talked to said that they wished there was something more sort of structured and removed from society that was sort of a halfway house in between combat and home. You know, they feel, especially guys that go back and forth every couple of years, are just yo-yoed between two worlds and find that they belong in neither.
It's a very hard thing to do, because even when they try and set up programs, they have it on the ships coming back, and there was a period where they put people on ships rather than airplanes to give them a period of decompression. But all the soldiers want to do is get home to their families, and you know, so even if you set up programs, they don't want to be thinking about it. And it's a very hard task. You don't just turn on a killer and then turn them off.
All of a sudden, you're in theater and you're being blown up, and then 2 days later, you're looking at your family on, you know, in the green. It's a wild experience, and you don't care because all you want to do is get home. That's all that matters, is getting home. But what is so important is that time in between there to talk the stories over with your friends, with your buddies that you were in those experiences with. And that's got to be one of the hardest transitions in the world, you know?
Has always been a part of my life. I don't like to call myself an artist, but I like to believe that expression is definitely very important, especially being human. We need to express our feelings, because if we don't bottle them up, they're going to come out the wrong way. Has definitely changed drastically. I used to paint with a lot of colors and used to paint with a lot of happy emotions. Now everything is more abstract. It's black and white. There's definitely more tension in the art. There's more, you could just tell I've changed completely as a person. Definitely. there's really no color right now. There's no happiness.
The story I think touched me more than any others in these interviews was the story of a guy named John Needham. He's a kid from California. Actually, he was a professional surfer before he joined the Army. And he joined the Army pretty late in 2004 when it was clear that the Iraq War was going pretty badly. And he thought to himself, well, here it is. Here's a time when my country actually needs me. And I'll sign up. And by all accounts, he was the best soldier in his platoon. The right hand of the lieutenant. Big, strong, smart, good-looking. Everyone liked him. According to him, on their tour in Baghdad, his platoon went dark. They started doing things that he thought were unnecessary. They started, for example, mutilating dead bodies and putting them on their Humvee and then driving around the neighborhood, which they suspected was full of insurgents, and they were probably right, and saying, "You're next." They started killing people that he thought didn't deserve to be killed. A kid on a bicycle, a guy walking down the street, and they would cover it up. And he didn't want to do that, and he turned against his platoon and they turned against him, and he felt trapped in this position where he didn't know there was no way out. It eventually drove him crazy, and he tried to shoot somebody in his platoon. After that happened, they sent him back to Fort Carson, because the model of that battalion was, if someone starts acting crazy and they're too dangerous to be in Baghdad, send them back to Colorado Springs. That's obviously a very dangerous solution for everybody. He got back to Colorado Springs and they told him they were going to court-martial him for trying to shoot someone in his platoon, someone he believed was doing something very illegal. Fortunately, his father, who is a well-educated, retired Army officer, intelligence officer, intervened and said, look, this kid doesn't need to be punished. He needs help. And so they got him into treatment for PTSD, but it wasn't effective. It wasn't effective, and his father finally brought him home after he retired from the Army. He couldn't hold a job. He just stayed inside all day, and he would have these flashbacks, usually during the middle of the night, where he would take off all his clothes and think he was back in Iraq, and he would hide behind furniture, thinking that there were insurgents everywhere. You know, his father didn't know what to do. He tried to get him committed to the VA hospital because he needed inpatient care, but there was no room, and he didn't qualify. And eventually, John Needham beat his girlfriend to death.
She was mad. She was waving her hands. She was about Renee. Renee and her yelled at each other.
What made you snap, John? What made you snap and beat her? What made you do that? That's what I want to know.
Made me snap and beat her.
Well, she's beaten to death, John, and you were the only other person in the room. So what happened? That's what we're getting at. What one thing did she do that would have set you off like that? She had to do something to set you off to pull the trigger, right?
I don't know.
You do know, John.
I don't know, okay? I'm a vet, okay? I have issues. I get set off. I'm set off over. I don't know.
He was arrested. Got out on bail, miraculously. His father put up, I think, about $200,000 in bail. And he later died under very uncertain circumstances of a drug overdose, whether it was intentional or accidental. But he was a guy who was so together, was such a sort of a someone who had everything, who was just totally undone by his experience until he had nothing left. And I think about him all the time and how it could have been really different for him.
And I recall one instance in specific. It stuck with me for a long time. I was representing an American sniper who killed a young, a 17-year-old, well, boy, 17-year-old boy, Iraqi boy's father. And I was expressing my sympathy to the young man. I couldn't possibly understand what he had gone through. And I felt terribly sorry, and I was trying to convey that to him. But what was most astounding about the young man was his own forgiveness for the soldier that had taken the father, his father in Iraq, in Iskandaria. And he said to me, he said, you know, this is Iraq. We deal with death every day. I'm sorry for the loss of my father, but this is what life in Iraq is life is like. And I'm, you know, I grieve for the loss of my father, but your client, he is a father too, and he has little children, and I don't want to see him taken away from his little children.
Everything that I've gone through, everything that my friends have gone through, I've forgiven. You know, and it's just, I can keep saying that word and hopefully it has set in somewhere in every person, you know, forgive, 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 and learn. It doesn't matter what someone did to you, it's not gonna make a difference. You can either let it eat the shit out of you or you can move forward.
Dad, everything must have changed. I say we did. Reach down and rearrange. Look what we did. What we did to ourselves. Now we're somebody else. Look at your heart. We did.
And there's a huge split between veterans. I don't want to label people as being pro-war veterans or anti-war veterans, but there is like a split in the middle. And then there's the people who are just hush-hush and don't talk about their experience. And I've had a couple of friends that, people that they knew in college didn't even know that they were a veteran for like 3 years of knowing them, you know? And that all goes back to being afraid to tell your story to somebody. But our stories are what matter. You know, this is really what is going to change our future and change our lives for our children and our grandchildren. And every generation to come is, they have to know of our mistakes. You know, just as much as we have to know of our mistakes and where we've made faults in our lives. Because if we keep doing the same shit over and over again, everyone is still going to be suffering.
We didn't have to go into Iraq. We didn't have to be there. We didn't have to do all the things that we did there. And we did. And one of the reasons that we did is I think that the American public, which is reasonable and averse to war but not opposed to it, was sold a bum bill of goods. If you had said to them, look, we're going to have guys like this, guys like the Lethal Warriors, we're going to have it for decades. It doesn't go away, and we don't really have a good way of treating it. I think people would have given things a second thought. And that's really why I tried to do what I do, is that if you don't have all the information, you can't make the right decision. And I don't think we did. And I hope next time we do.
We have seen the destruction war brings to all sides. We have struggled to comprehend the horrors of war inflicted through more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, or envision the many years of healing these millions of soldiers and civilians require. The legacy and fallout of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars belong to my generation and those that will come after us. We have grown up watching these wars unfold through events like Abu Ghraib, Haditha, and the Stryker 5 killings. We have seen the million U.S. soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan return home to face increased unemployment, high rates of alcohol and drug dependence, mental trauma, and suicide as a result of their experiences in battle. A number of factors contributed to the misconduct and crimes committed by members of the American military, both abroad and upon returning home. Some soldiers should not have been in the military or in conflict zones in the first place, whether due to behavioral issues or underlying mental disorders. What lessons should my generation and future generations of Americans take from Iraq and Afghanistan? To better screen who we put in uniform and train to kill? To properly train and supervise members of the military and maintain high standards for conduct? To better recognize and treat trauma from military service? All of these things, clearly. But the common element in these horrific events is war itself. Fighting better supervised wars with a better screened and better trained military will do little to shield against the horror of war as a traumatic experience. Even as the U.S. welcomes its soldiers home from Iraq and Afghanistan and realizes the damage done to thousands of its own, some of our leaders call for additional wars. So the question remains, have we really learned the cost of war?
You can find today's documentary on our website at www.presstv.ir/doc for one more week. Please don't forget to share your comments and questions about the program. Don't forget to email your messages, questions, and comments to documentary@presstv.ir. You can join the discussions on Aperture's Facebook and Twitter. We look forward to your thoughts, comments, concerns, and stories. That's it for this edition of Aperture. Thank you for watching, and until next week, goodbye.